flight or unmanned cargo flight. And that's just a very simple cheap cargo bay that maybe doesn't have to be returned. And so we get more payload into this one, thereby getting our cost effectiveness. And in all these respects, I kept on urging Rocketdyne to really look seriously in oxygen hydrogen engines. Rocketdyne, however, was very strongly on Air Force engines. They were in competition with Lockheed on the Agena, and they wanted to come up with something that the Air Force might like, and the Air Force was not too interested initially in hydrogen. They were more interested in fluorine hydrogen and RFNA hydrogen and N204, nitrogen oxide, tetroxide and hydrogen, which then was chosen for the MHD, and nitrogen tetroxide and hydrogen mixture, which was then chosen for Titan. And so, you know, we couldn't get them. I couldn't really interest them too much. And then when Centaur was all of a sudden frozen, Pratt & Whitney went, that really stung Rocketdyne. And they really went into the act and started looking at engines and looking at larger engines. And with the intent of knocking Pratt & Whitney, if at all possible, out of the saddle, in which they were vis-a-vis the Saturn V, and offer the Marshall team a better engine than the 6, which wasn't really a nice engine in the world. But it was, of course, already a big performance improvement over any earlier application. And they were successful with this, and that led to the J2. That was the next big engine. And so that's the way Rocketdyne got into the, that's the way that the engine was ultimately changed, and eventually then the 71B really arrived. And the upper Centaur S last stage, I think it was a C5 stage, something like that, never came about, because then Saturn 1B became Saturn 1, and then, of course, with Saturn 5.
The change is missing. Saturn was for a deep space probe. Nobody wanted to go to the deep space. They wanted to go to the moon.
That's right. And then came the change in mission, of course, and Saturn 5 became that principal mission vehicle. But what had happened was that the road was indeed open to oxygen hydrogen, and it's now firmly in our arsenal. And it would be unthinkable if we really continued to develop the Nerva engine to do that if we didn't have that kind of oxygen hydrogen exchange that we now have through the Saturn vehicles. That's how this came about, and that's how we often went different paths in the basic approach to the vehicle design, but it was based not out of philosophical convictions, but simply because I had no alternative to a small vehicle like that. I would not have made that design allowed to get big stages like the F2 and the F4B. Not at all. And so after that one was settled, really, we looked then later on still at larger systems. Marshall got interested and wanted to know how we could build larger systems. And of course, one thing that comes immediately to mind is if you do build a still larger system, you better be totally reusable. And that led to, I got on a contract that time that led to the Nexus vehicle, which was the first of the blunt body type booster vehicles. So it was basically blunt and designed for blunt re-entry and had really what looked like a second or third stage for really with huge payload spaces, which gave it then the somewhat more aerodynamic form. Once the payload spaces were taken off, there was a blunt body that came back into the atmosphere. Douglas later on picked that one up, Phil Bono, turned the vehicle around and came in engine first. I came in head on first. In engine first, and that led their rhombus design, which follows, but the ancient idea of the blunt body has become very, I know it very definitely came out of our stable. And I presume something like a blunt vehicle will come about once we get over the shuttle and get back. Right now, you can talk to anybody if everybody is so shuttle oriented, but we need eventually a large freighter, which gives us something of the order of $10 a pound, which the Nexus or rhombus design can do. And I think in the 90s we'll return to that. That will be, in a way, a continuation of the history from the V2 to the Atlas and the Centaur and the Saturn, and then this one.
And so the space shuttle is kind of a deviant from that program?
From that program, it's a deviant in the sense that the space shuttle is for small payloads, mm-hmm. I mean, small by standards of these large boosters. Mm-hmm. And it's a perfectly appropriate payload for the present time. 40,000 pounds, thereabouts, is a fine payload. I don't care if it's 30 or 60 or 50. So, but you see, when we get to build larger structures, and I could hardly begin to tell you why we should build them, and I think why we will build them by the year 2000, 2010, structures like these, 2,000, 3,000 man Acropolis station. And but you could not possibly do that with 40,000-pound launch vehicles. Launch vehicles have 40,000-pound payloads. You need launch vehicles that have upwards of 1 million pounds, 1 million and 4 million pounds, and that are reusable. That is possible. And in a way, I'm sorry that I'll be long retired by the time by which this swings back, because we did a lot of work, and I expect that I'm still alive to see some of these ideas reemerge. But there's no question that the first step right now is the shuttle. It should be done. But then maybe after we have that amortized by the late 80s, we'll be allowed to go into a big freighter, a reusable freighter. So. Now, as I pointed out, I always look at where else can I use it, and is this a dead-end street, or does this have a growth potential in its development? The hydrogen, to me, was not a dead-end street. Everything like hydrazine or any of these other things looked like. It goes through a long development, then you have a vehicle, then you find out for the next step is you cannot use it. And so the hydrogen was not only good as a booster, but it was also a very interesting propellant for interplanetary flight until we get to the point where we are using pulsed nuclear detonations, in which case we will not necessarily need that anymore. We will need just to evaporate metal, at least metal gas. But that's a totally different situation. And so, therefore, I also look very intensely at launch vehicle by interplanetary vehicles. Those up and in studies for NASA really led to what is somewhat today known as a typical NERVA type interplanetary vehicle.
There's a very active NERVA program now?
The NERVA program is not too active at the present time. I had testified before Congress back in 59. I was asked to testify, and I supported the NERVA program all out. I was, in fact, Harry Finger and Stan Ulam from Los Alamos, and Harry Finger from NASA, and several other people were there. And also, Bill Bish from Aerojet in these hearings. And my support was based on the assumption, which I published in second 59, that if we do have a nuclear powered vehicle, rather than just all this chemical, whether it's heavier or lighter propellant, but a nuclear powered vehicle that gives us at least 700 or 800 seconds, then we can conduct fast reconnaissance missions to Mars and to Venus. And pointed out the fast flight profiles where we make a quick flight out, stay for a little while, and then on a longer flight back, go inside the Earth. I stumbled at that kind of a profile originally when I worked for a science fiction novel where I introduced a mishap at the planet. They had to return. How would they return? They can't return along the Hohmann route. They have to wait 500 days there at Mars. And then looking at other ellipses, all of a sudden there was a whole family of life forms opening itself up that could potentially be used. And from there I went into the utilization of solar energy for maneuvers near the perihelion, where I had not very much bearing solar distance, very high solar heat intensity, and used a collector and heater in lieu of a reactor to heat my hydrogen and dump it out at 750, 800 seconds specific impulse, which now was another branch off. And this turned out to be very effective, although not quite as effective as the Venus flyby, which, because that's purely gravitational, but very much better than breaking the Earth with a conventional chemical propulsion system. I almost cut the departure weight of the interplanetary ship in half, roughly 60% of it. By this maneuver alone. It was never published. It was called Expedition Ares. It was unfortunately never published because I spend more time. I'd be glad to give you a copy of it. I still have that.
I would love to see that.
Okay, that's absolutely. I'll send you a copy. I have it in my file at home.
Okay.
I don't have it here.
I'll write you a note.
Please do. I mail it to you. It's all typed out. It has the fictional part and it has the technical appendix. But I spent more than the technical appendix on the fictional part. And then I send it to some science fiction journals. Today, I was crazy to try it. It was really, It had strong emphasis on the technology. But it was then, it was in the early 60s, that I found, my God, we have a whole family of fast explosions that nobody has thought of. And Brown still used very nicely the good old Coleman flywheel. Everybody else used it. And I used it too. Yeah. Only in my case, I wanted to have something going wrong. I had human conflicts because of my story and all that, and it's all, and everything was involved, naturally. I thought that's necessary to get the time. But then I wanted to have a mishap, and I lost most of my oxygen. And I was, what happened was, there was a very bad maneuver that had to be conducted because they almost collided with an unknown little Mars moon. You know, I had to do that. It hadn't been seen from Earth. I always tried to have to make a very rapid maneuver as a result of this. They lost most of their oxygen in their food, and it was perfectly clear that if they had to wait 500 days for a return flight, they would all die. And so they started figuring out, what can we do? How can we go back? In other words, it was the first time, I mean, anybody thought of an interplanetary mission aboard. What do you do in a mission like this? And so I looked at, and all of a sudden I saw, my God, there are a number of orbits. And so I started calculating. So I was so absorbed into finding and in developing more of these families of orbits, and then published this in the AFME, incidentally, as it was in 69. So the original novel was written somewhere around 52, 51 or 52. But then over the years I developed more classes, and then I published the whole thing in the AFME journal in two parts, Fast Reconnaissance, Manned Reconnaissance Mission, Venus and Mars. Introduced the concept that we should have probes with us to stay in orbit, possibly, and just land the probes down there, and so on and so forth. And try to find my way back here. The idea was that this might be worthwhile if we can do it by 72, 74, somewhere around that time. Now, in 59, 60, that looked like a long time away. It looked like we might be able to do it. And I had actually, I'll send you a copy of this ASME thing too. I was primarily thinking about 73, the 73 and the 75 mission. So I wasn't trying to be too optimistic, although I couldn't help myself feeling that maybe we might even make 71. But anyway, but 59, it didn't seem to be so, but I was still cautious and I said, well, maybe 75, but I thought I was pretty darn conservative. Well, anyway, and so I supported this. So the years went by, and this thing dragged on and dragged on, and then they sold President Kennedy on it, and Kennedy gave it a boost. And it became apparent to me that, my God, this thing is getting completely out of hand. If you plan a certain thing and say, I want to start development A here because I want to fly mission A prime here, because I want to be able to fly mission B over here. Now, all of a sudden, A slips down that much so that A prime will smack into B. Then I've got to re-examine the situation and say, do I still want to do this? Or should I not rather better drop A now and better go to what I really need for B? So I started to look at the gas co-reactor, and I looked at the TUF, the nuclear power, and looked at the fusion. I worked with a number of people in this field, including IAC people. And so I became convinced that the TUF is the answer. The TUF was at that time brought on at General Atomics. And General Atomics was a sister division of ours, so I worked with them, did much mission analysis with them. And their design is wonderful, but I was thinking of bigger designs because I'm thinking of that we do need definitely to eventually mine on other celestial bodies. The only propulsion system that becomes cheaper and of increasing performance, the bigger I build it, is the pulse system. So that was for me the ultimate answer. I published for years all sorts of things about the pulse system. Anyway, by 1966, my thoughts had coagulated to what I thought was a new scenario. I'd seen this thing dragging along. I talked to Harry Singer, and Harry said, don't plunge the, I said, I'm going to stop talking about other propulsion. Don't plunge the data in our bank. You know, if the rover program is being canceled, you know, then it won't be replaced. And then later on the nerve, it won't be replaced when you have nothing, so let's at least have that. I said, but Harry, this thing is turning from a driver into a brake. It just holds up everything else. And I'm no longer believing that even those fast reconnaissance missions are really sensible. The reason why I'm saying this is that it became very quickly apparent. I worked in the early years very much with JPL on the probes and tried to push the probes. Got to get some of this program. But primarily, I guess initially, I really only thought of flyby probes and maybe orbiters and so forth. But it became very quickly apparent, you know, with all the ingenious work that was done at JPL, that these probes were capable of handling more. And now, when you start then sitting down and think about what these probes can do, you find very quickly that you're beginning to compete yourself out of the fast manned reconnaissance mission. And in one of the last studies for Marshall and NASA, and I made as head of the advanced studies section in Columbia, back in 63-64, all right, my conclusion was that number one, flyby missions are totally out, which we had originally for manned considered. Totally out, because they could be, by that time, already obviously done so much better by unmanned probes that it makes no sense. Flyby mission, I figured it to about $21 billion, and even something like Voyager was not more than $3 or $4 or $5 billion. So in bits per dollar and in useful bits per dollar, whatever other fancy stuff you want to put in on this, it became perfectly clear that this is not compatible. But many people, especially of the younger male group members, a little bit like Harry Roper, for example, they were very taken with the flyby. They thought that was the thing to do, and they thought that was the only thing that could be done. I think there was a little bit trotting here in North America, which felt that if you zoom up Apollo a little bit, then you can indeed make a manned flyby mission mark swing up into the asteroid belt and come back. Well, I don't know how you can seriously assume it can do this and even penetrate into the totally unknown environment of the asteroid belt, which is actually beyond me. That was pushed in those days. In fact, I began to doubt whether even brief capture periods are still useful in themselves, the basic idea being that now we may have orbited long before the nerve is ready. So what's left is really a type of mission. The type of mission that is really superior to the unmanned is a kind of a mission that one may begin to have serious doubts whether the nerve can do it. And then I went through a dual evolution. By 66, I reached the conclusion that I felt that the Nerva wasn't really worthwhile. So we should maybe drop it and directly go to something much better, preferably in the top, or maybe the fusion, or at least gas co-reactor, and have a big time period of unmanned probes. In other words, let's put the 70s and the 80s and the unmanned probes, and then maybe perhaps in the late 80s or middle 80s at the first. That was 66, so it sounded like if you went then when. And everybody talks still about we can make by 77, we can run still a flyby mission. So when you said 82, 84, it sounded like very far away, very conservative. Today, that's no longer conservative, but you know everything changes so fast. But in 66, and then in the 90s, have at least the gas cost, not the pulse ready, and then really go all out, really make it. In the meantime, I have studied further and have come up with a mission profile, which is very exciting, which could be used by any propulsion system. But it does the Nerva relatively the most good. I just presented that not too long ago to Marshall. And there's some interest there in kind of the advanced with the lunar and planetary propulsion. And that simply, in principle, is you take the Nerva propelled spacecraft, send the crew out, and do not include a return capability. Just do not include a return capability. And then then actually what amounts to practically a space station over there, literally a very, very sumptuous surprise, because your payload is almost increased by a factor of 3, so you have plenty of payload. And then start rotating crew. Keep that stuff there, and then with a minimum mission module, start making some of the fast flights, and then reduce your stay time to just a few days. I don't want to go to necessary to a flyby rendezvous and this sort of thing, but only reduce it to days, which already cuts down the difficulties in the return flight very much compared to the original concept where you wanted to stay as long as possible, maybe 6 weeks or 8 weeks, and then finally you're still here again. Flyby got closer and closer to the sun, and eventually the window was closing. You know, when you took the last bus after 6 weeks, daytime was, so you really had a heck of a fix. You had to rush home as fast as you could. Now you wouldn't do that. You would stay only a few days, and thereby the return flight becomes a lot easier. So that's an interesting thing which would make maximum use, especially of the shuttle and of the let's say a cislunar nuclear ferry. Mm-hmm. But it's still only a preliminary answer. The main line should really be the pulse or something of that sort. But anyway, there are still some possibilities open, and we may see some of the hydrogen activities derived basically from what originally we all thought, I think, was a booster possibility. Maybe the rover program, especially here at North American Rocketdyne, they were looking very strongly at having a nuclear booster. I worked with them at that time, so I know about their plans. And because I worked on the structure for their booster, maybe they have got into the engine, the nuclear engine. So the NERVA program dragged out and dragged on and dragged on. It still is not without redeeming features. But my God, if we don't have it, at least by the early 80s, then I think it should really, we should really take the knife to it. But replace it by something else. That's good. What is a different story. I would think we should try everything possible to replace it by a nuclear pulse. So I don't, it depends a little bit on what you want, whether you should keep the NERVA alive or not. There are alternatives in the cislunar travel pattern where you don't necessarily have to have a nuclear ferry. A nuclear ferry has a big advantage that its booster, which boosts away from Earth, and then you have all that heavy booster structure and all the return propellant that you need later on when you come back to Earth. And that has to be slowed down. It has to be, or rather, accelerated from around the world to target, and then has to be slowed down and returned before it can be used. Mm-hmm. You see, if you had a dual flyby, where you have an elliptical orbit and put a space station in an elliptical orbit, and here is, let's say, the inner terminal orbit and this is the outer terminal orbit, that elliptical orbit would oscillate between the inner and outer terminal orbit, you would have a dual flyby situation, right? And now you use small fighter type transport, little transport, ITVs, interorbital interstation transfer vehicles, between that elliptical space station, shuttle station, and the terminal space station here and here, and with a minimum of dead weight, to make an apogee transition out to the terminal or from the terminal back into the elliptical as it goes through the apogee. And the same thing on the other end. And if you do that, then you can, with chemical propellant, come down to a fast factor, which is as good as with a classical ferry with nuclear. Maybe about 6 to 7 pounds of propellant per pound of payload transported round trip, from lower to the geosynchronous or from lower to lunar orbit, rather similar. And so there are various alternatives. And if we zero in on some of these alternatives, then the NERVA is going to be in real serious trouble. And am I deviating too much at this moment? From put me back on the track if you.
I'm really interested in what you're talking about.
I know, we're getting off the Saturn thing a little bit, but so let me just...
You so much bowled me over with the presentation. I was just going to have some minor questions to answer on Saturn. I just assume that you do whatever you'd like to do.
No, let me just say that because of our development, mm-hmm. because we were, I hate to use that word, but if you take it judiciously, as I mean it, we were the principal antagonists of the other line mm-hmm. to Marshall, namely the low-weight pressure-stabilized line mm-hmm. under the influence mm-hmm. primarily of the genius of Charlie Bartlett, and the successes that we have and the pride of our management, that even the successes we had, that we broke the Centaur ice and so forth, that our proposals were, of course, taken, looked at most judiciously by our friends at Marshall, and we bid for the second stage, we bid for the third stage, we even bid for the first stage, and of course we couldn't swing it. We didn't make it, I guess, some of our approaches were too ingrained, deeply ingrained. I was not directly involved in the proposal making because I was busy with Centaur at that time, but our then advanced the design department made some of the proposals, and they were largely relying on pressurized structures. They had some good points, but you know, nothing is totally and absolutely rational. People have certain innate preferences, and Marshall just didn't feel comfortable with a huge pressurized structure. I can't say whether rightly or wrongly, but I certainly can't blame it. I would say approach. Those were the good ones, and it worked. So, making money. That's what us. Back in 162, we made many proposals, but we didn't really do what they thought might be the best thing. And then they finally did decide that we better design most of it ourselves. And Razik went ahead and gave them, not somebody doing what I tell them. Going into the sky, they guided the driver. Yes, guided to talk about details of the origin of the S2 because I wasn't with this company.
I
thought
the bill
not those I would be amazed. However, I think it is true that probably both doctors in North America had psychologically and somewhat greater freedom. The main pride of Ratzinger and his team was definitely connected to the state, with which they were most familiar. Had probably a little bit more freedom than Boeing had comparatively. But the mood at Marshall in those days was, we better run the show. We don't want to get anything wrong. If that thing goes wrong, you know, this is really a catastrophe the first order. That might not go wrong in Apollo. And so they did keep a tight rein on all statements. But I wasn't here and I cannot see it from the studio. I only do it by inference. Of course, all of a sudden, Marshall was swamped with the responsibility of three new stages. With one stage capturing their attention tremendously in the first one. It was possible that they simply couldn't handle it all and thereby also by default let a number of students go. But they probably reviewed them very, very well. Yes, that's right.
And that comes from you. I
can't prove it, but I am quite sure because there was no design excuse that before that. Whatever, there was no design change. There was absolutely no design. And Lewis worked on an engine, and Pratt and Whitney worked on the engine. Pratt and Whitney worked on the pump. Pratt and Whitney worked on the pump. And initially, I didn't even know anything about the pump because when they finally did decide in the effort to at least move in the direction of being serious with an hydrogen powered bomber, everything bomber, they said they were most afraid of the pump. Frankly, I was more afraid of the tanks than of the pump, maybe even because I was English. But the effort was